few weeks ago, we had a snow day. And every now and again, I think it would be great if I could just reuse that sermon for the next year. It's never, ever worked out because my sermons are often the function of the interplay between the week's events and the parasha of the week and what I'm thinking about over the course of that period in regards to what our tradition has to say. This week, there are three things that have been foremost on my mind. One, I've been reading the book Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. It's actually going through my entire family like a flu virus. It's a terrific accounting of a life in northern Kentucky and southern Ohio and the decline of working-class whites and Appalachians in the past decades, both by macroeconomic policy and by intercommunal failure. I also was invited by Lo Presser to attend the downtown vigil on Wednesday in support of immigration and refugees in our community. As I've said before, there are some things I think the Jewish tradition might be ambivalent about. I think it's very hard, as some of my colleagues do, to make a case for gun control through Jewish life. But there is no doubt in my mind that our tradition is solidly behind the rights of the immigrant and the refugee. Again and again in Torah and elsewhere, we hear about it. And the third thing on my mind is an incredible movie that I highly recommend to each and all of you called Moonlight, which is about a young man growing up in Miami, in the Miami metro area, and eventually in Georgia. And sort of the interplay of race, poverty, and gender identity in his youth. So all these communities of which we are part, the overlapping Venn diagram of circles that determine our lives, and yet the Jewish community, to use Wendy Bestman's phrase, is its separate circle, again, unto itself. And we describe ourselves in various places as Or LaGoyim, a light to other nations, which gives many in our community, and certainly in the Jewish world historically, the license to be triumphalist, the license to be superior or chauvinist. Now, some of that is an insecure reaction to the fact that historically we have been very insecure. Our position is very precarious, so it's nice to think that God loves us especially when the rulers of France in the 12th century don't seem to. But what does Or LaGoyim really mean if we were to understand it in a non-triumphalist, maybe a more postmodern way? What does it mean to be a light or an enlightened people or a people that shares light with other nations? And this is a great parasha to think about it, because there are two items I want to talk to you about today that describe light and darkness. First, the curse, the plague of darkness that the Israelites receive, that the Egyptians receive in Parashat Bo. And second, considered by many sages to be the first mitzvah, the announcement of what will be the first month in the calendar, the month of Nisan. Those two counterpoints I want to use to think about what it means today, in February of 2017, to be Or LaGoyim, whether you're Jewish yet or not, to be a light and an enlightened person that shares that wisdom and light with others. So Moses lifts up his, this is chapter 10, Moses lifts up his hands towards the heavens, and there was a full darkness, a kind of radiant darkness, on all the land of Egypt for 3 days. That's verse 22. Verse 23 says, a person could not see one's fellow, and a person could not get up from where one was resting for 3 days. Yet, all the people of Israel had light in their dwelling places. It's a lot of interesting midrashim that gives rise to, a lot of wonderful rabbinic imaginations of what it means that people couldn't get up. You know, were they fearful to trip? Were they fearful to stub their toes on their children's Legos? That is, maybe that's just me. That probably didn't exist for Egyptians, but that's the terror I currently live, the tyranny of children's Legos underfoot. It was actually an article that described why Legos are more painful to feet than other things. Scientifically proven. So what we're told in Midrash is that there were 6 days of darkness, and during these period, during the last 3 days, if you were sitting, you could not stand up, and if you were standing, you could not sit down, and if you were lying down, you could not get up. Kind of like depression. But what we understand from our sages is that the darkness was a supernatural darkness, a darkness with form. It was not a darkness that was void. It was a darkness that had presence, like a dark matter, so to speak. That's the beauty of the imagery of that. That's the rabbinic understanding of the symbolism. But what it means, metaphorically and ethically, is a question that was answered centuries later by the Chiddushei Harim, who was the first of the Ger Rebbes in Poland, living more or less in the 1800s. And he says that the moral question here about darkness and our relation to Egyptians, the Egyptians of our day, the Egyptians of his day, the Egyptians of Torah, those who are not us, those who are other. There is no greater darkness, says Yitzhak Meir Alter, the first of the Ger Rebbes, than one in which a man does not see one's fellow, in which a person becomes oblivious to the needs of one's fellow man, one's fellow person. When that happens, a person becomes stymied in his or her personal development as well. That is to say, you can't get up from your place. That empathy, that fellow feeling, that trying to persist and exist out of one's narcissistic self-interest is a form of self-growth. And that the way the Israelites had light in their dwellings, one could say, this is not in the Ger Rebbe's telling, but a nice imagery that occurs to me now, is that they shared that light with others, that they were sources of light, that they were capacitors of God's divinity that they expressed to their fellows. And that even seeing, as we know in the flight at the sea, at the Reed Sea, and God's destruction of the Israelites, that God is not grateful or joyous or triumphalist that God brings plagues to the Egyptians. In some small ways, God wishes God could lessen the decree, and we act as God's emissaries to do that, to bring light to others. There's an incredible tradition called the Or HaGanuz, the concealed light, the hidden light, the reserved light is often what it's called, that it's one of the things created at creation but occulted from the world to appear only in the end of times, and there's a reserved light. This is also a Kabbalistic image. Light that's held for the righteous in abeyance. That it's there for us at the end of days and maybe at our darkest moments. That's one of the images that comes forward in Hillbilly Elegy. The faith that there is something waiting for us, that there is not reason, not cause yet to despair. And Menachem Mendel of Kotsk says that the Or HaGanuz was what allowed the Israelites to exist, why they had light in their dwellings, that they received a foretaste of that forbidden and hidden light that kept them motive during the period of the plague. It made everything illuminated, to use Jonathan Safran Foer's sage phrase. Being Or LaGoyim means having light in darkness. It doesn't mean being superior. It doesn't mean being special, at least not in the sense of no one else having a covenant. Even in Torah, we're told that other people have covenants with God or with their understandings of God, and those are legitimate relationships, that they are not false or inane relationships. But our covenant of God impels us to reach out, to share the Or LaGanuz, even though our sages understand that being Or LaGoyim and having an Or Ganuz, Or HaGanuz, a hidden light, is only for us, is a special decree for us. But as we manifest God in the world, you know, we show it. Not to be a Shanda for the Goyim like Bernie Madoff was, but to do the opposite, to manifest God's goodness through our actions, to show others the possibility of redemption. So we have chapter 12, verse 2, which many of our sages accord as the first mitzvah of Torah. I feel like there are mitzvot in Genesis, for example, pru uravu, to be fruitful and to multiply. But for some accounting, mitzvot don't really begin until Exodus, until God reveals words and commands and precepts through words. So Rashi, when Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, begins his commentary in the 11th century, his very first comment, and if you have Hakol this month, Rabbi Wilhelm quotes this comment, cites Rashi on Genesis 1:1. Rashi likes to ask, why do we begin with creation? Why start here at all? If the Torah is a book of instruction and law-giving, where I would focus on the instruction, why not just begin at this very verse, chapter 12, verse 2, when we have our first instruction, how to begin the calendar, which is no small thing. By knowing the calendar, said my rabbi, you understand Judaism, you own Judaism. I've illustrated to our children at KJDS when they came here for Sukkot and talked about it with others that by virtue of living a Jewish life, you know when the new moon is, you know when the full moon is, you know what's coming in the calendar. It attunes you to a different set of realities and circumstances. So this question of calendrical occurrence and the new moon and the full moon and how the holidays will be set is non-trivial. In fact, there are chapters in Talmud, one of the first chapters I ever studied, the second and third chapters of Rosh Hashanah in Talmud, that talk about in very great detail how one accounts for the new moon, how one cites it, how one attests to it, how one promulgates the idea that it is the new moon. If anyone saw the Lord of the Rings movies, if you remember those bonfires on the hillside, I don't know if it was based on our tradition, but there is imagery that we had bonfires on hillsides and shofarot and trumpets that would convey the news from one community to the other. That's more or less the reason you have 2 days of Yom Tov as well, because we didn't have digital and seamless communications. There was always a lag as information reached. So when the new moon would be declared in Jerusalem, it took a while to get to the hinterlands. And that's a large subject for pages and pages, folio pages of our Talmud, of how we make those decisions. A non-trivial thing. We as a people, and we understand the solar calendar, we intercalate our lunar calendar to the solar calendar, unlike Islam, for example, where Ramadan moves every year. Our holidays don't move significantly. They stay in their season. Rosh Hashanah will always be in the autumn. Pesach will always be in the spring and around the rainy seasons of Jerusalem and Israel. But we are, say many of our sages with regards to this week's parasha, a people understood by the moon. The Zohar says that the people of Israel set the calendar by the moon because they are the moon of the world. Which is a very odd thing to say. Because you'd think if you had enough ego, you wouldn't claim the moon. You'd say, I'm the sun of the world. If you feel like you're an Or LaGoyim, why not be the sun? Why not be a star, a permanent fixture in life? The moon waxes and wanes. We don't see it much during the day. It's a secondary light, certainly by physics, and I think they understood that it was not as powerful as the sun. Why choose that as your emblem? There's some humility to it, I think, but also some beautiful imagery. So the Sfat Emet, who is the grandson of the Chidushei Arim, the Rebbe that I mentioned earlier, he's Yehuda Aryeh Leib Alter. He lived just into the first century, this 20th century. Talks about this. He says that Israel counts by the moon, whereas Gentile nations, and certainly the Greeks and the Romans, count by the sun. The nations only stand when the sun shines upon them at midday. You know, the Roman Empire had a crest, and it fell off. As the sun faded as on the Roman Empire, it ended. We only study Latin as a dead language. Likewise, the heights of Polish and Spanish life, but the Jews persisted. Whereas when the day darkens, these empires of the sun are raised and removed from the annals of history. Japan. In contrast, Israel can stand and shine even mired in darkness, following the example of the moon shining in the dark night. If you have the fortune to go see that movie, Moonlight, it's not 100% clear why it's named Moonlight, but one of the suggestions is something like that, that there is darkness in the world and the light is not always perceptible, But the aspiration is to feel that light, to be warmed by moonlight, though it doesn't really project warmth, but to be illuminated, to learn about oneself, to experience one's identity, to give to others by the light of the moon. That there is a lesser light that in our tradition is no less important. It teaches, it illustrates, it gives us a path to walk on, even in darkness. And if we live, at the very least, in interesting times, to quote the Chinese aphorism, we as the Jewish people, as people who are part of a Jewish community, whether we are Jewish or not, are entrusted with that light. We're not or la goyim because we're special and superior and we have every right to be chauvinist. We're or la goyim because at our best moments, at those rare moments when the world seems dark, we can carry forth a message of hope and faith and civility and prayer that the future be better than the past.